Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. The hat out front should tell you. Don Moeller is joining us for this one, and this was a buy request for me, but before we get to this incredible book and local story and one of the worst stories that we've heard in the sort of local times around here, I do want to promote some of the best stories. Taharka Ice Cream makes some of the best ice cream, not just here in Baltimore, but anywhere in the land, the Honey Graham Ice Cream. They support us. They sponsor us. They're doing good things around here in Baltimore. Awaken more than just your taste buds with Taharka. Also, our friends at State Fair, usually local guests like our next guest, we would usually go out and get some shrimp and grits or some chicken and waffles. We would do that out at State Fair. We would have some crab cakes down at Lexington Market, at Fadley's, which we'll be able to do in Catonsville at some point next year. But obviously, in the era of COVID, we are gloved and washing our hands, and hopefully you're shipping those crab cakes from Fadley's and stopping over and socially distancing the way my wife and I did for a delicious raspberry waffle and some delicious chicken last week. Don Moeller's son, Jeff Moeller, is closing deals at Moeller & Gary Realty. Had him on the program last month at WNST.net. You can find that out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault. Don Moeller, I'm going to let you be the calm politician guy and county executive, and I'm going to let you do the honors on this one because I requested this. You were more than delighted to make this interview happen, and I know we're excited about this, but not too excited because the topic is, in your opinion, maybe the worst of all the things that have happened in Baltimore, right?
It's a very sad topic. We welcome Brandon Sutterberg and Baynard Woods, authors of I Got a Monster, the most corrupt police force in the United States of America. That is just wonderful on a show called Baltimore Positive. But we try to take a look at this and we try to learn from it, guys. And welcome so much. Thanks for joining us. I want to start. I'm going to give both of you some oxygen here, as Nestor likes to say. Let's start for a minute. And we've had, just background for you guys, we've had Police Commissioner Harrison on. We've had former Police Commissioner Kevin Davis on. We had all the mayoral candidates. We've had the gentleman who's going to be the next mayor. We've had Brandon Scott on three times. So we've talked about Gun Trace Task Force a lot. We talked to Sheila Dixon, who's a key player in all this. So let's start as if there's some Rip Van Winkles out there. And there are people listening now, and they go, Gun Trace Task Force, what are these guys writing about? What is it? So you guys take it from here and educate our listeners and tell them what this story is all about.
You want to start that, Brandon?
Sure.
I'll pick up from you.
Yeah. So the Gun Trace Task Force was a group of Baltimore police officers, detectives, and a sergeant who were a plainclothes police squad that were federally indicted in March of 2017 for a number of crimes tied to racketeering and conspiracy. They basically charged with the kind of stuff we charge the mafia or gangs with. That included robbing people, stealing drugs, redealing those drugs, violating people's rights, and stealing a lot of overtime. And since it's kind of seen as a criminal conspiracy, it stretches back a long time, you know, as far back as 2010 in terms of the charges. And basically, it just traces these seven officers initially, who were all indicted on March 1st, 2017, that were in a squad together that were robbing and dealing drugs and doing a lot of other terrible things that police shouldn't do. And since then, another previous sergeant from the task force was indicted. And then since then, five or six other officers have been indicted. So it's the investigation's ongoing. So that's kind of the big basics of what the police were doing. But there's kind of a lot of co-conspirators and people like that that I think Boehner will probably talk about.
Right. So, I mean, one of the reasons that we debated a lot about calling it the most corrupt police squad, America's most corrupt police squad, partly because of you know, Central and South America having very corrupt in Mexico, but also because of there's corruption in police departments all around the country. But we felt like that this was really a super group of grimy cops who had all been committing criminal acts with other members of the police department before they came together. And there's this moment in 2016 where they all ended up in the same squad, and three of them had their own separate drug dealers outside of the department working for them, one of those being a police officer in Philadelphia, one being a Maryland bail bondsman, and another one being the lifelong friend of one of the officers in the squad. And that's how they came onto him. The Department of Justice Civil Rights Division was here doing its investigation into the police department, but that wasn't how they caught them. In fact, their office was right next to the GTTF office on the 7th floor in headquarters downtown, and that helped give them cover as people were coming in. Drug dealers were coming in. They were able to say to the other cops that they were DOJ guys. So they weren't worried about that, but they were trying to trace heroin that people were using in Harford County back to Baltimore. They got a wiretap on a dealer's phone and they heard him talking to a police officer. They busted a different dealer and they found a BPD, or not a BPD, but a GPS tracker that was registered to a BPD officer up under the car when they took theirs off. And so they started to think something was fishy. They got a wiretap and they started immediately hearing that they were robbing drug dealers almost every night. They thought getting a new sergeant, Wayne Jenkins, might put the other guys under control, but instead it ramped it up to levels that they hadn't imagined before.
Well, guys, and I know I'm looking at Nestor's face. He's just stunned.
I mean, the issue for me is where the seed from the first thought of a cop inside thinking, I can create my own mafia in here, get drug dealers on the outside, that this would continue into perpetuity, that there would not be at some point somebody who got wind of this who would not whistleblow this. That you could feed all the mouths that it took to feed for as long as it did to keep this silent as it was an ongoing active nightly crime, as you guys have pointed out.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because it's so layered with that. So, like, they were taking cash with each other. Jenkins' squad, some of the guys in that, Ward and Hendricks and Taylor, they weren't comfortable with Jenkins stealing drugs, but they were all stealing money. So Jenkins would tell them, oh, I'm going to take all this weed back and burn it in my backyard. And then he would take it to, or I'm calling up. They overheard him on the phone with someone that he was saying, he's like, hey, I'm giving this to the drug dog guy so he can train the drug dogs. And for a while he lied about his dealing with them. But then, because they stole money together, there wasn't really much they could do either. And they testified that stealing money was one of the ways that plainclothes police officers trusted each other. You were out there on the streets. You needed to know these guys had your backs. So if you took some money, you split it up with them. You knew y'all all had a level of trust that was different than just the official levels of trust.
Guys, they finally get caught or indicted, I guess, in 2017. Walk our listeners back. When does it? I like Nestor's question. The seed. When it begins. When does it actually begin? When does the first actor in this morality play dream this thing up?
So that there's a lot of places to start. One place would be as early as 2003 or so, when a sergeant that was later indicted in Keith Gladstone was kind of caught lying about he was caught on camera lying. He lied, and the probable cause showed that he lied because he was caught on camera. That was about just sort of routine police brutality. But what we know is that when Jenkins, the sort of sergeant at the time, joins the police force, he starts very soon, and he's mentored by this guy, Gladstone. When Jenkins enters the police force, he's already starting to sort of work snitches against each other and develop a sort of network of snitches, and he's paying off people for protection and information. And so he's using, it's kind of this duality where he's using this information he's gaining for police purposes of arresting people, including drug dealers, but he's also using that for intel to rob and sort of enrich himself. And then, Gondo, another cop involved, was known for his connections to an Alameda, a group of heroin dealers in the Alameda. And it's hard to tell, but something we sort of have seen is that very early on, Jenkins and Gondo at the time weren't working together. We're sort of already walking around in these criminal underworlds. And so it seems as though it almost started in the early 2000s when these cops became cops. They also realized, hey, being a cop is maybe not a bad way to be a drug dealer, not a bad way to be a robber. And then it kind of just, and so all these cops are working separately. They start to work together and it kind of builds and builds from there. And it so it transcends quite a few police commissioners, quite a few mayors, and it sort of hits its head in 2016 because these seven cops come together and have this kind of criminal gang where they really have a crime spree that runs through the summer, which is the sort of big second chunk of our book is about that crime spree.
And the earliest case that we have guilty pleas for that you may remember back in 2009.
Boehner, so I'm having a little audio just into the microphone if you can. That's all.
Yeah. Sure. So back in 2009, there was a case that there were just guilty pleas on and just new charges brought. But it was touted as the biggest cocaine bust in Baltimore history, 41 kilos. And they stole several different officers that weren't in the Gun Trace Task Force. Have now pleaded guilty and been charged for stealing or for lying to the FBI about stealing to that since the statute of limitations was out. So we know they were stealing and selling cocaine as early as 2009. 2010, they chase a guy named Umar Burley. That results in a car. And he said he thought they were trying to rob him. Sean Suter was in the car with them at that point. The detective who later was shot in the head right before testifying against the Gun Trace Task Force to the grand jury. He was, they pull up on this guy, Umar Burley. They start chasing him. He crashes into a man named Albert Davis, who was the father of a police officer, and he died in the crash. And Jenkins called a sergeant who still hasn't been named, who came and planted, gave him an ounce of heroin to plant on that guy, who ended up spending 8 years in jail over the planted heroin and the manslaughter over the car crash.
Well, again, it just gets...
You just bring up Sean Suter, and we'll get to him at the end. Well, that comes later.
Exactly. There's so much here. And, I mean, if we thought that David Simon was writing a fictional account of what was taking place in Baltimore, we now scratch our heads because Simon, he had bad stuff in there, but... This is about as bad as it gets. And the question that Nestor and I asked both Commissioner Harrison and we recently asked former Commissioner Davis, and there's no other way to put it, guys, so I'm going to ask you the same question. How the hell does this happen for a decade or more and everybody's looking the other way? Are we to believe no one knew this was happening?
I mean, the paradox is that they were the same things that made them be such good criminals is also what made them be celebrated police officers. And so if they were doing, especially as we have, whenever there are crime spikes, murder spikes, then the real desire isn't to watch out what the police are doing. It's we got to get the bad guys with guns. And so the mayors would put that pressure onto the commissioners. The commissioner would put that pressure onto their people below them who would put the pressure on, and Jenkins was one of the people that would deliver there. And so they were more than willing to look the other way as long as they were bringing in the numbers and doing this award-winning police work. And at the same time, by the end of it, once the war on drugs, the prosecution of the war on drugs became less of a priority, and it was more about getting guns than about drugs, they had more incentive to steal drugs because you're not going to get these big rewards and press conferences for the drugs anymore. And what's the difference of 8 kilos or 5? And the criminal's not going to say, the suspect's not going to say, you know, Your Honor, I actually had 8 kilos.
I had 200,000 in the safe instead of the 100,000.
Money are we talking about here, fellas? I mean, that is at least calculated, not to mention, you know, the $100 handshakes that went on and the garden variety, couple $100 thefts here and again on the street. How much money was really accounted for in all of this?
I mean, the it's hard to tell, but it sort of has been put around more than, like, it's kind of just said as millions. I mean, when you start calculating the amount of drugs that were also brought in and things like that, it goes up.
Oh, was this a lifestyle issue for the cops? I mean, I'm wondering, I see this as a Sopranos thing, and I'm not as familiar with it. I mean, your book is illuminating. When this stuff was going on and the Sean Suter thing was going on, quite frankly, as a citizen that lives at the Inner Harbor, it's almost so grisly and gruesome that you do want to turn half an eye away from it and just say, oh my God, how deep into that rabbit hole do I want to go? I haven't watched, we talk about David Simon. I haven't watched the television show yet. It's been 2 decades. You know, I'm famous as the last guy on earth who's waiting to live in Maui or something to go watch that because I still live here. But there is the point of it where you do turn away from it a little bit, but you go back to it now and you say years later, what's to stop this from happening again?
Right. I mean, I think that one way to really understand it, which doesn't help your problem necessarily of wanting to look away, which I totally understand, but one way to look at it is that a lot of this is kind of the logical extension of a lot of policing that's happening, where it's like when we start to encourage cops to sort of just go out there and arrest a lot of people, we'll figure out what we're arresting forever. It creates a lot of chaos, and so it makes it easier to steal. It makes it harder to be accountable. You know, we've mentioned this quite a few times, but these guys were stopping up to 50 people a night, pulling up on people, grabbing people, see if they had guns and drugs. They had a gun, they'd arrest them. If they had drugs, they'd keep the drugs. And so there's that. And then on top of that, in terms of the scope, you really have to think about the crime that this created. There's the crimes they're committing, that, you know, robbing people. There's also a lot of crimes that this creates, because if a drug dealer is robbed of a lot of money and then he gets arrested and then he has to tell his sort of plug or whatever, yeah, the cops came up to me and took all my cocaine, and then the guy's going to be like, oh, you weren't charged with that or anything. It's like, no, it got stolen. That kind of stuff really creates, that's going to be a debt that you owe. And in fact, the book details the story of a guy named Davon Robinson who was robbed by the task force at $10,000. And then they also arrested him for a gun. He was then arraigned for the gun. When he left his arraignment for the gun charge, he was followed and he was shot and killed over a drug debt that he owed because they stole $10,000. So someone unrelated to the task force didn't get $10,000 because the cops got it, and he shot this guy, Davon Robinson, and killed him. And so when you start to think about that kind of collateral damage of it, when you're thinking of in terms of like the human cost or the economic cost, it's really hard to not connect it to these cops adding to the crime spike, creating crime and making the city even more unsafe and more chaotic, which paradoxically as cops made them more needed, because the sort of cop side of them could then be like, hey, look how crazy it is out there. People are getting shot. You need to give us more leeway to do what we do, even though what they were doing was creating crime. It's kind of this really vicious cycle.
It's like, oh yeah, almost like mice on a pinwheel kind of thing. Vaynard, I want to jump back. You said something a few minutes ago, and I had to process it. I couldn't jump right in because I wanted to make sure I heard what you said. And correct me if I'm wrong. I heard you say that because of the results they were getting, bad guys, bad gals, locking them up, getting convictions, that those in power were willing to look the other way. Now, when I hear that, my antenna goes off and says, so you're telling me that some higher-ups in the police department and some elected officials knew what was going on and sort of gave it a wink, wink, nod, nod. Now, I don't want to assume that without you having a chance to clarify it.
Right. So it's complicated there. We know that some of his higher-ups knew what was happening and were either involved or looked the other way. In the one case, Jenkins ran over a man while the car was still on him, called his sergeant that Brandon mentioned earlier, Keith Gladstone, who came and has since pleaded guilty to coming and giving him a BB gun to plant under him. The sergeant that he called when they caused the death in the car crash brought an ounce of heroin to plant. So these are things that he is involved with his superior officers. Do I think that the commissioners knew what was happening and looked the other way? I think they wanted to not know what was happening. I think as in all sort of positions of power, the thing you want to know if you're up, you want to be insulated so that when people start asking who knew what when, you can say, I didn't know. I mean, we do know that D'Souza ended up coming down with this because of being involved in the same kind of tax scams, with seemingly the same fake sort of fraudulent CPA that one of the cops ran was. So there was some. And that we also know that when Jenkins was caught on camera lying about statement of probable cause, planning, it seems like, going into someone's house, getting the cocaine from his house and putting it in the van, when they were caught doing that, there was a big IED investigation. The state's attorney's office tried to bring it to the grand jury. They didn't get an indictment, and MBPD, a higher up, stepped in and told him to let it go and not to demote him. And instead of being demoted, he came back stronger than ever. Instead of not being even called as a witness anymore for the state's attorney's office, he becomes a star witness. So it's, I don't think that they knew, especially about the stealing. It's harder to, but I think about violating people's rights and stuff, that's part of the way the game is played in Baltimore.
Well, you just mentioned, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Brandon.
I would just add that, like, one way of thinking about how the higher ups kind of look the other way is these officers were getting an outrageous amount of guns every night. They were getting a lot of guns, which is good for the department. But it's like if you had a salesman that was just selling like 300% higher than everyone.
Oh, this is baseball. You're willing to put up with Albert Bell if he hits seven.
Yeah, exactly.
Runs, right?
Yeah, that's actually a good idea. Yeah, exactly. That the steroid comparison is really similar.
Antonio Brown, he catches touchdowns. We'll have one on
right. Exactly. Right. So like this idea that with guns, it's like they're getting a lot of guns. I don't know how they're doing it. I don't want to know. And I think that's kind of an easy entryway into that. Like, and so whether they knew the deeper, darker conspiracy is unclear, but they certainly look. And then, Don, you mentioned convictions. I mean, another thing that was really wild about this that the defense attorney, Ivan Bates, who we kind of follow as he starts to uncover this, did a lot of number crunching and pointed out that the number of arrests for these guns that resulted in like a conviction and not just a case dropped was incredibly low. So even the effect it had on like actually keeping people who had guns in jail was really low. But this initial thing of like getting guns, they were like, that's great. I'm just not gonna ask any questions. We'll just keep it moving. I think that's where I think it's the most damning for the leadership.
Well, what role, guys, and I've read, I haven't read your book. I'm going to. I've read reviews and I've read excerpts and I've read interviews. Read a lot about the Gun Trace Task Force. It's never clear to me what role the state's attorney's office was playing the whole time this is going down. Give us some sense of where the state's attorney is in this drama.
Yeah, and so the it goes across a couple administrations, as Brandon noted. But one of the really good examples was in the summer of 2016, and it shows how they thwarted so many ways to deal with reform. And when we're talking about higher-ups, it looks at judges and prosecutors. So the very first day that this squad had a body camera, Daniel Herschel was the only cop that had one. He turned it on after they'd made the stop, so it didn't do what it was supposed to do in the first place. Then he thought he turned it off. He walks up to another one of the cops, Momodou Gonda, who says, "I really wanted to hurt that guy." They think it's off. They then decide they're going to go break into his house. And all of this is on body camera footage as they have him in the back seat of the car. He was a Safe Streets worker. They're talking about how they need to get rid of the violence interruption program, get rid of Safe Streets with him. Herschel is, while everyone else is rummaging through his house without a warrant. When Ivan Bates brought that to the judge and the prosecutor was like, "Oh, no, no," and hadn't watched the body camera footage all the way to the end and just basically denied it, that it was a relevant issue for the charges against the defendant. The judge said, "Oh, it sounds like a good lawsuit to me, but we're going forward with the case," and didn't really want to know anything else about it either. There was another case where the warrant was missing entirely that they used to raid some condos down in Canton, and they couldn't find the warrant, and the state's attorney's office was willing to work to get a brand new warrant months after the arrest had happened and say, "Oh, look, well, here's the warrant that was signed in January of 2017 when the arrest was in July of 2016. And so they were really pushing for prosecutions, and I think as often didn't want to know about their officers or turn over to the defense the problems with with their cops. And the case that I mentioned earlier of Walter Price is a great example. The way the state's attorney's office tried, and this was under Bernstein, tried to bring that to the grand jury was a prosecutor named Molly Webb saw the camera footage and was like, "This is bad." And she sent it up to their officer integrity, to the top of that bureau within the state's attorney's office. And that got things rolling. But Jenkins was let go. And then Webb ended up getting in trouble with the state's attorney's office. So it seemed like there was even someone high up within that office that was looking out for Jenkins as well.
We are discussing the book, I Got a Monster. Brandon Soderberg is here. Baynard Woods is here, along with former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, doing some Baltimore positive about one of the more negative things. And certainly this makes quite a book, fellas. I mean, I've written a couple of books and with happy endings with ravens and whatnot, and I usually say to authors, why this book, why here? I guess there was so much meat on the bone to tell this story for people who would be interested in the story. I guess the question for me is, who busts this the next time? You know, like, how does the house of cards get brought down? And thinking, is this going on in the Denver Police Department, or is this going on in Mayberry somewhere in the South? And maybe there's not enough drugs or money in certain police departments or guns to be able to put together this sort of a mafia network inside of a police department. But we always talk about, like, losing the Baltimore Sun and the Sun busting Catherine Pugh, and who brings people to justice in our modern era. We hope it's the police, right? We hope it's the legal system from Washington, D.C. straight on down. But who does bust this the next time this happens? And we hear about what's going on in Baltimore and federal oversight and all this stuff. But who's to say that, I don't know, Bill Barr's not corrupt or something like that? Just saying.
Bill Barr is probably corrupt. But yeah,
I'm just saying.
Yeah. But no, I mean, that's an interesting, the question, I think that's one of the interesting fears that we learned talking to some of the defense attorneys and the federal prosecutors was that, you know, this investigation began under the previous Obama administration. The indictment came down during the Trump administration. And there was a real fear that the Trump administration would not especially be interested in busting dirty cops. And as some of Donald Trump's rhetoric these days, he seems to think that cops need to be even more aggressive or more corrupt. And so how this gets accomplished on a federal level, I'm not sure at this point. There are a few other examples. There was recently a civil lawsuit, nothing this extreme, but there's a civil lawsuit against a gun recovery unit in Washington, D.C., and that's mostly about violating civil rights. But we've heard a lot of stories about a gun recovery unit in D.C. operating similar. There was a New Jersey police squad that was doing very, very similar things that was arrested not that long ago on a state level. And so I think that the lack of transparency in police departments oftentimes, and the amount of, as Bayard sort of said, when crime spikes, we sort of just decide, let these cops do whatever they need to do. I think that absolutely creates more corruption. Who exposes that next? That's a good question. I don't know. What do you think, Bayard?
Yeah, it makes it hard with, you know, you mentioned the Sun, and there are so many fewer, just to go back to the 2010 case, there was Urbanite magazine, there was City Paper, there were a lot more outlets to be doing independent investigations, building off of each other's works. And as we get fewer and fewer journalistic outlets, we have police unions really fight so hard against any measures for transparency. It's very hard to get a hold of internal affairs records. We've seen that some of this gets revealed in court. In bench conferences is a great place to hear about what cops are doing when they're doing things wrong. When the lawyers are up at the bench and there's the white noise to keep the jury from hearing it. You can hear those on the recordings at the court reporter's office. We're actually engaged in a federal lawsuit against the courts right now to make those be broadcastable as part of a First Amendment right with a legal clinic out of Georgetown law. And so that's one, we think that more transparency would make it more likely to catch them, but it is my one fear, I guess, is that some, like you mentioned, some cop in Mayberry is reading this book like right now and saying, that is a great idea.
Right. Honey, we can get the new car. You know, that to me, as, and Nestor is right. I guess as someone who spent a career in public service and cares about whether or not people believe government can work and whether government and its agencies care about them, that's why this is so troubling. And we asked Kevin Davis, and Kevin was really forthright with us, and he gave us sort of a mixed answer on this particular question, and it was the rank and file. When the poo finally hit the pan, were the rank and file happy that these guys were caught because they were giving us a bad name, or was the rank and file saying, man, that's not right. These guys didn't do anything all that bad. What did you all find?
For the most part, I think the rank and file was really happy that they were caught. A lot of people didn't like Jenkins anyway, that he was aggressive and would try to fight other cops at poker games and stuff too. So there was some personal, and people thought he would send an email out to the whole department every time he got a gun. And people wondered, like, you can't get that many guns constitutionally. But then also when they saw the level of money and drugs and stuff that were involved, the stolen watches, I think it's hard for them to say. It's sort of like, I guess I imagine in journalism, like, we aren't mad when you bust a plagiarist, you know, it's like, or a fabricator. You're generally happy, like, get that guy out of here. And last night I was looking, a bunch of cops were tweeting about the book and just like, asking exactly the question you were just asking, how can we stop this from happening again, rather than, and feeling sick and feeling disgusted by it. So not being greatly glad, having mixed feelings. How did my department allow this to go on? Who else is involved? Not knowing who to trust around you, but a certain sense of relief to know that these people who are willing to cross a lot of lines aren't going to be the person you're assigned to be beside, who then is going to put you in a really terrible situation.
Does this happen without Wayne Jenkins? Is he the Tony Soprano of this? Is there a gun trace task force without Wayne Jenkins?
I think there is something like it, but I think he was a uniquely brilliant criminal. And I think that's something that's worth noting, is he was especially good and especially ambitious at doing this. But I do think that this kind of criminality operated before him, or officers who I think showed him how to do it. But I think he kind of took it to another level. And so I think, would it have gotten this sprawling and over the top? I'm not sure, but would it have happened? I think it was operating in some ways before he was there, and while he was there, he just sort of turbo boosted it or something.
Yeah, to add to that, I mean, because we can look at all of the scandals going back decades, King and Murray and Daniel Redd, who was selling heroin out of the police car in the precinct parking lot, and all of those different cases, they were doing some form of this. Hey, we're coming in front of a bunch of money and a bunch of drugs every night. And so there's a certain natural temptation to cross that line. But the kind of things, and they probably, you know, there would have been smaller catches like that, but the kind of ambition that Jenkins had also, you know, made them have a bigger fall. He was double and triple crossing his own squad. He was pushing the other people too. So he pushed Rayum to sell heroin and cocaine, and so then Rayum reached out to a cop he knew in Philadelphia. So that allowed the corruption to spread to another police department, and the Philly cops started selling it. So his constant, I mean, the way they talked about him, you see that he really is unique. I mean, there's this bit on the wiretap where Gondo and Rayum just spend 5 minutes going back and forth going, he's off the chain, off the chain, off the chain. And they just can't believe the stuff that they see him doing. And so, you know, that when he and Rayum, I mean, was a guy who dressed as a mailman to sneak in somebody's house and rob their house. And he thought Jenkins was at a whole nother level. It really shows you where they're at.
You know, I don't want to let this one get away. And Brandon, I'll let you take this one on Sean Suter. Tell me the story. You know, if I don't know anything and I just come in from another place, just that story unto itself on the back end of all this, you sort of brought that in the early part. But that's sort of the cherry on the, you know, on the whole story of how corrupt this whole thing is, right?
Right. So Sean Suter was a police detective who was found shot in the head. He died a day or so later after he was shot. There's been a discussion about whether it was a suicide or a homicide. The departments and the state's sort of investigations have declared it a suicide. Suter's family says it's an inside job, meaning police killed him. He was shot in the head the day before he was supposed to testify against about the Gun Trace Task Force officers to a grand jury. And so the timing there is pretty fortuitous. And that homicide or suicide has not been solved. It hasn't been formally declared a suicide, and there's been no one charged with it as a homicide. And that, as Boehner described, reaches back to that 2010 case with the chase and the planted heroin and the Albert Davis, the man who was killed. So Suter knew about this stuff, and then 7 years later it came back and he was willing to talk, and he lost his life. I mean, one of the ways, we don't, to be clear, we don't solve that in the book. I don't want to promise too much, but I would say that our sort of way of looking at it when we were writing and discussing it was that the police department killed Sean Suter, whether the corruption that surrounded him became insurmountable for him and he took his own life tragically, or because he was going to talk, he was killed by police. Either way, I think it's the department and its dysfunction, its corruption that that took Sean Suter away a day before he was supposed to testify against these officers.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the unintended consequences for random guy walking in the street who gets shaken down in all of this. This is the, I'm around and I'm a witness to the crime and I'm a police officer, whether I whistleblow or whether I don't, and what the consequences of that would be in the secret handshake society that we've all wondered, how did this go on so long? If you were on the periphery and saw this and you were willing to step out and say that's wrong, they were willing to kill you maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we, in the case of Joe Crystal, you know, that what didn't have nearly such dire consequences, but he was a whistleblower within the Baltimore Police Department shortly after the event that Suter was part of with the Umar Burley thing, and he saw his sergeant take someone back into a house and tune him up, and he told us assistant state's attorney that it went up, and he ultimately had to leave Baltimore as a result of it because they were putting rats under the windshield of his car at his house. When he'd call for backup, no one would come. And so they send a very clear message of what happens if you, you know, cross that thin blue line and talk about your fellow officers. And the other thing that's more complicated is Mamadou Gondo, one of the detectives, testified that he and Suter had stolen together before. So, you know, when Brandon mentioned the complicatedness of the Gun Trace Task Force, all of these plainclothes guys shuffle around from unit to unit to unit and work with a bunch of different people. So the amount of dirty things you know might be a lot more than even the one thing that's coming up. And so you really, the number of people that might want you separately, something to happen to you becomes pretty great.
Guys, I have one more question, but before I ask that question and we let you get on out of here, I'm sure that when folks are listening now, they're saying, I've got to get this book. Take a minute or two and promote your book where they can get it before I ask you my last question.
We really encourage you to get it from local bookstores. Any of the ones in town, Atomic Books, Greedy Reads, Red Emma's, Charm City Books, they've all been really great to us, but they've all been really suffering over, you know, 5 months, going into the fifth month of a pandemic now. And the day the book came out, Jeff Bezos made $13 billion. So spread the money locally. It'll get spent locally as well. Rather than they look out for us all the time, and we need to look out for our local bookstores.
Great message. I encourage everyone who's listening or watching, get this book. It's a must read. It's got to become part of your library. Fellas, last question that I have before Nestor jumps back in is, if you had 15 minutes with Brandon Scott, just the two of you in his office talking about police reform, what would you ask him to focus on? What are the two or three ideas you'd like to leave him with to say, as the potential mayor, this can't happen again, and if you listen and do these things, mayor, it won't?
I've spoken to Brandon Scott quite a bit, so maybe I'm kind of cheating in here. I've had 15 minutes with him, but generally I'm asking him questions, not telling him how to do his job. But Brandon, if you're listening, yeah, I mean, I think that the main thing
and he didn't have the job of mayor before.
You're true. Yeah, you're right.
And he does.
Yeah, you're
listen.
True. You're right. Your change. Yeah. But I would say that I think that well, for example, something I spoke to Brandon Scott about recently is we did a piece for the website The Intercept about these cops harassing violence interrupters, people within community to try to stop violence. These cops arrested those guys. So I think I would encourage Brandon, and I think he already knows this, that violence interruption, those community forward programs can really stop violence, and that would lessen the load on police and would also decrease the possibility for corruption. I'd also just say that I think he really needs to push for more transparency within the police department in terms of the law enforcement officers' bill of rights, which really makes it really hard for cops to get fired, for us to even find out that officers have internal affairs complaints. For example, Ram, one of the officers, was got in trouble in 2009 for stealing a bunch of money, and he was able to come back to the police department. That's something people didn't know at the time. It was sort of hidden. And so that forcing that kind of transparency on the police department would be important. And the last thing I would say, which I think Brandon's already been doing, is just trying to stand up to the police unions, which I think are a real impediment to progress in the city.
Well, Nestor, how many times in our discussions have we heard about the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights being an impediment to trying to create transparency in police departments?
Well, we're trying to clean up the cops. I mean, as simple as that. Baynard, you got something for our incoming mayor?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing that I think he should really watch out for is the way that the police unions and the various other sort of advocacy groups try to leverage violence against the citizens. We see it happening all over the country now. As people, the more people talk about police reform, the more talk, well, you're going to see this horrible violence happen. And that's the moment when we all look away that we were talking about earlier, when we're like, oh, as long as they're getting the guns, we don't really care anymore. And so, like, the most important thing he can do is to keep his eye on the ball and not let the political pressures that come from what are you doing to stop the violence make him just give the police whatever they want. I do think advocating for to get rid of entirely the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. I mean, it's crazy also that the consent decree that the judge said last week that, you know, when people are talking about defunding the police, that's not even an option for Baltimore because the consent decree carries a certain amount of funding required with it. And so we, in some ways, rather than having lessons for Brandon Scott, I think we as Baltimore have a lot of lessons for other cities that are going through some of the same problems that we went through 5 years ago. And so I'd also encourage mayors of other cities to read this book and look out at the things that could happen to you in a post, you know, sort of uprising against police world.
You guys have been great guests, man. We really appreciate it. I want to put the book up here on my phone it blinks off. I got a monster, The Rise and Fall of America's Most Corrupt Police Squad. Baynard Woods and Brandon Soderberg joining us here on Baltimore Positive. Guys, appreciate it. I know it's tough work, you know, going out and researching all this and getting it out and selling books and all that, but certainly a hell of a story you guys told, and I hope you don't get to write a part two of this one, and if you do, it's how we got cleaned up and we got a happy ending here in the opposite of The Wire 10 years from now. I don't know how we're going to get to that ending, but I do appreciate the insights and the truth being written as a citizen. All I want is the truth, right?
Thanks so much. It's really been great to be on and talk.
Hold that book up, man. You got the real book. Hold that up.
The real book. There we go.
On behalf of Tom Moeller and our friends at Taharka Ice Cream, our friends at State Fair and at Fadley's, and our friends at Moeller and Gary, he is former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller. I am Nestor Aparicio. Together, we are WNST.net, AM 1570. Calm, local, and Baltimore Positive.